Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with one of the top experts in the field. Author of the bestseller Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, Ellen Brown's pioneering research started the national movement to create new American public banks. We'll look at developments in the banking industry, economics, and money itself, and we'll update you on developments on the public banking frontier. Our program is underwritten by Payment Management Merchant Credit Card Services at paymentmgmt.com. And now, here's Ellen.
Thanks, Walt. Well, we're just back from a great symposium on public banking in Santa Fe, New Mexico. The mayor, along with the city council and other local notables, are actively pursuing the idea of establishing a Santa Fe city-owned bank. The event featured economist Richard Wolff and me as keynote speakers, and we're delighted to have Richard on our program today. He is professor of economics emeritus at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, where he taught economics for 35 years. He is currently a visiting professor at the New School University in New York City, and he has taught at Yale and the University of Paris. But his claim to fame of late is that he is in great demand as a public speaker. Marxism, his specialty, has suddenly become popular. Great to talk to you, Richard.
Thank you, Ellen. Glad to talk with you.
The New York Times Magazine has called you probably America's most prominent Marxist economist, and Cornel West calls you the leading socialist economist in the country. But in your writings and your copious speaking, you are actually advocating something beyond socialism. Can you elaborate on that?
Sure. I think that the folks who enjoy using labels like Marxist and socialist and so forth are in many cases, not all of course, but in many cases, thinking about those terms in the meanings they had for most of the 20th century. But like all major movements of human society and human thought, the meanings of the key words change. For example, we have a Supreme Court, and one of the jobs of the Supreme Court is to basically monitor and change the meanings of key terms in our society, whether they be civil liberties or privacy or democracy. It turns out that people disagree, which is perfectly understandable, and that sometimes you need to come to some sort of consensus about which of the competing meanings are going to be used, particularly in law cases and so on. And I mention that only because socialism, Marxism are likewise very profound terms about society, about which people have always differed, and among which big changes in meaning have occurred. So, for example, when I look at socialism and when I interpret Marx's writings and the writings of other Marxists, I come to conclusions, I reach notions of what those key terms that they use mean that are different. Particularly different from those ideas that were, and those meanings that were dominant in the 20th century. And I'll give you the most important example. Socialism, communism, Marxism, were terms that in the 20th century were understood to refer to two basic ideas. First, that society would be better off if the means of production, capital, land, factories, machines, things like that, if the means of production were owned and operated by the government on behalf of and in the interests of all the people, rather than owned and operated by private citizens who would make decisions in their own personal private interest that would diverge in important ways from the social or societal interest. And so the socialists argued basically that there should be a transition from private ownership of the means of production to government ownership. And indeed, when Marxists and socialists made revolutions in places like Russia and China and Vietnam and Cuba and so on, that's what they did. They transferred ownership operating power of at least the industries over into the hands of the government. The second big idea of traditional socialism was that you should not allow the market to determine who gets what among the resources and among the products of human labor. In other words, if you had, 100 loaves of bread produced by bakers, then you shouldn't distribute the bread according to who had the money to pay for it. The bread should rather be distributed according to some plan that where the bread would meet the greatest need, and that the government was in the position to determine what people's needs were and then to organize the distribution that way. So in short, if people had to thumbnail summarize socialism for most of the last 100 years, they would say government ownership of enterprises and operating them, and government plans rather than markets as the way to go. And for me, while I understand the logic behind that argument, and I'm very respectful of the fact that across the 20th century, these ideas changed from those of a handful of Europeans into something believed by billions, with a B, billions of people across this planet. Socialism became a significant movement in literally every country on the face of the earth, so you have to be respectful of such a thing, the way you respect the spread of Christianity or Islam or other major ways of thinking and organizing life. But I am also critical, and I think that's a reasonable thing to be. I think that there was a misunderstanding or an insufficient understanding that if you put all of that power into the hands of the government, the power to own and operate enterprises, and the power to distribute both resources and the products of labor, you take a risk that this kind of concentrated power in the government could be abused, could be utilized in ways that do not, in fact, as they were thought to, reflect and honor the actual needs of the people of a society. And I think there were aspects of the history of the Soviet Union, the People's Republic of China, and so on, that make being skeptical on that point very much a reasonable position. In any case, it's the position I hold. And so I, like, by the way, many others, have decided that one of the things a better socialism, a different and better socialism, would have to foreground would be a way to understand, to apply, to concretize Marx's critiques of capitalism, to do that in a way that gives the predominant social power position, decisive position, economically speaking, not to the government, but rather to the mass of people. And the way we've decided to move in that direction has been to say that the main emphasis we're going to give in the kind of socialism that emerges and we think will predominate in the 21st century that we are now in is a socialism that says our focus is going to be not to change who owns the means of production and not to change how you distribute them. In other words, that's not our focus. We have no quarrel with what conventional socialists did in that area. We think they're good arguments for not allowing private groups of people to own and operate enterprises as individuals in the capitalist manner, driven by profit. And we think there are good reasons to think that distribution can be done much more socially effectively and much more fairly without using the market. We're not fans of distributing scarce goods to the people with the most money. Strikes us as a strange argument at best. But our focus is elsewhere. We think that socialism means a reorganization of the enterprise, the factories, the offices, the stores, where people spend most of their adult lives at work, 9 to 5, 5 out of 7 days a week. That has to be reorganized, and it has to be reorganized in a fundamentally democratic way, that the commitment to democracy that we have, that most people share, has to be institutionalized at the workplace. And what that means is all the people at the workplace, from the managers and the supervisors to the factory workers to the cleaners to the secretaries, you name it, they have to be understood to be a community collaborating to produce goods and services. And that community doing that should operate democratically, with each person having an equal say, an equal vote in making all the basic decisions, what to produce, how to produce, where to produce, and what to do with the profits that, after all of them have collaborated to produce. So that the key focus, and I think you'll see this more and more in the years to come, and you can already see it in the growing interest in and movement for workplace cooperatives of all kinds, that the focus is going to be on that as the major change. So that whatever powers are given to the government as part of moving forward, that those powers will always, in the end, be dependent on how we organize enterprises, on the democratic participation of all of us as working people in one place or another, controlling democratically the real wealth and the economic foundation of society at the level of the enterprise, that will be a way to limit the government, to make it perform in the way we want, because the ultimate power on which even the government will depend will be located in a democratically organized system of workplaces.
Well, that sounds great, and I agree. But I did hear Gar Alperovitz give a workshop in which he said the problem with all these cooperatives, like in Ohio, where they do have a strong cooperative movement, is that you're still competing. You may, within your organization, you may have a wonderful democratic structure, but you're still competing with businesses that do not, you know, that will cut corners, that don't worry about the environment, et cetera. And so everybody is reduced to the lowest common denominator. They all have to cut those corners in order to not be put out of business. So it seems to me you still need government regulation. And the problem with government is it's a question whether the government represents us, the people. You know, if it really is we, the people, who are the government, then that's fine. But the problem is that it winds up getting dominated by people who are not representing us.
Well, I have two responses to that. The first one is that all of us have to do a kind of special intellectual leap. It is very hard for us living in societies like we do now, not just in the United States, but globally, to think about how governments might work in a radically altered economic landscape. After all, we grew up in, we have formed our concepts of what government is, in a society in which government interacted with capitalism. And it's crystal clear, and everybody knows, that capitalists have been extraordinarily successful and have devoted huge amounts of resources to being in charge of the government, to controlling the government. For example, over the last 40 years, as everyone knows, the distribution of wealth and income in the United States has become much more unequal. The top 1% or 5%, depending on how you count, have gathered into their hands a much larger share of annual income and a much larger share of total net worth than they had 10, 20, 30, 40 years ago. It's been on a rise for quite a while now, and whether you call that the disappearance of the middle class or you do it with statistics, everybody, with the exception of a few conservative spokespeople, understands and sees this. Well, here's a corollary of that. If you're one of the 1% or 10% or top 5% or whatever it is, if you're a wealthy corporation, or if you're a wealthy individual or family, and you watch over 30 or 40 years your position becoming relatively more and more wealthy relative to everybody else, sooner or later, unless you are very, very unintelligent, it's going to occur to you that your accumulated wealth is making everybody else, let's call it jealous, let's call it envious, let's call it resentful, whatever the words you want. And that the people who are jealous or envious or resentful, for good or bad reasons, really doesn't matter at this point, such people are going to look around to see if there are ways that they can improve their situation, to do better relative to you, to offset how much better you've done relative to them in the economy. And those people tend to look, sooner or later, at politics. Why? Because in politics, in our society, we have universal suffrage. Everybody votes. And in the normal practice of this sort of a system, if you have a vast majority of people who feel the way you do, you can prevail in getting political change. Well, the vast majority of people are precisely those who have suffered economically in the last 4 years, whose situations have deteriorated. Their incomes haven't kept up with those of the rich. Their wealth has fallen behind. They're going to turn pretty soon to politics. They're going to try to see if in the political realm, where they are the majority, they can pass laws that offset at least some of the growing inequality in economics. And we know that because it's American history. In the 1950s and 60s, politics of the people who are the mass of the working class were much more successful coming out of the Great Depression and the war. And so, for example, the top income tax bracket on the wealthiest Americans, just to take one example, was 91%. Every dollar over around $40,000 that you earned in the 50s, you had to give Uncle Sam as a federal income tax 91 cents, and you got to keep 9. The comparable rate today is 39%. And what that shows is that people who were rich were able, over the intervening years, to use their wealth to exert influence on the political leadership to change the situation, to make them pay much, 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 much lower tax rates than they once had to pay. Indeed, that's part of how they've become relatively richer than everybody else. But we live in a society where we've come to take that for granted. We see signs of it every day, that basically the bigger you are as a business or the richer you are as an individual, the greater your influence you and others like you have over politics. So we've become a nation very dubious about government, very skeptical, bitter in some cases. We even have people who think that the government is so bad that it really has nothing to do with anybody else. There's some intrinsic quality to government that makes it bad. And so it's very difficult to try to imagine a government that functioned differently. But I think that's an act we always have to make. We always have to be a little bit imaginative when it comes to thinking about how we could change a society and how in a changed society government would function differently. But in the story I sketched in response to your first question, I think we can see more than a glimmer of light. Governments, in the end, depend on the rest of society for whatever revenues they have and therefore for whatever they can do. The government cannot function if individuals and businesses don't pay taxes, to be as crude and simple as I can. Government knows that and everybody else knows it. In our society, a huge portion of the taxes is paid by wealthy people who can afford it, and by large corporations, although particularly by wealthy people these days. And there are limits to how much of the taxes you can push off onto the middle classes and the mass of people. And corresponding to the bigness and the wealth of big business and wealthy people, government has served them. But in the image I sketched, if you democratize enterprises, if you make workers democratically decide how enterprises work, then the payment of taxes to the government by an enterprise would be undertaken because the democratically run enterprise has made the determination to participate and will use whatever influence it has for the benefits of large groups of people, people who represent many different communities, people who represent different levels of skill. You do not have a tiny 1, 2, 3, 4% of the people who are the wealthiest and who also run the big corporations, because those are in fact the same people. You don't have that tiny group of people wielding the kind of power and wealth they once had. To make it very more concrete and dramatic, imagine a corporation which at the end of the year tallies up what profits it earned and then turns to the question, which every company has to, what are we going to do with the profits we earned? In a conventional capitalist corporation, a tiny group of people, the board of directors, 15 to 20 folks, sits down and makes that determination. And if they are influenced in doing that, the major influence comes from the major shareholders, because those are the folks that put those board of directors into existence. They're the ones who elect who's on that board. So we have a tiny group of people who decide to use the profits of the company in the ways we've now become familiar with, among others, to pay humongous salaries to the top executives, etc. If this were a democratically run worker cooperative in the way that we are now moving towards, I think, you'd never see that. They would never distribute, you know, $100 million pay packages to the CEO while everybody else in the enterprise has trouble making ends meet. It just wouldn't happen. That's not the democratic outcome. What they would do is distribute things, bluntly, in a much, much more egalitarian way. There would be highs and lows. For example, the most famous worker co-op in the world today, the Mondragon Corporation in Spain, has a rule that the highest paid cannot earn more than 8.5 times the lowest paid. Here in the United States, by the way, there is no such rule, and in corporations, big ones particularly, are running at about 250-1 in that amount. So I don't think you'd have the inequality in the first place that divides people and that makes them put such divergent pressures on the government. So you have to think that the whole role of government, the whole responsibility of government to the people, the whole array of different interests and wealth holders as they pressure the government would be different in the kinds of society I have. So I'm much more hopeful that the outcome will be policies and programs much more genuinely geared to what people need than anything we have been able to see in a capitalistically grounded governmental behavior of the last 100, 200 years.
Mm-hmm. Well, my favorite solution, of course, is public banks. I mean, it seems to me that at the federal level, there's not much we could do. If we could, there's a lot. I mean, if we had control at the federal level, you could do. I'm in favor of a trillion-dollar coin, et cetera. I mean, there are many things you could do to get money out there. But everybody knows that Wall Street owns Congress.
Right.
So we pretty much have to work at the local level. But it seems to me that you could set up a public bank that would be effectively using the tools that Wall Street uses. I mean, what we do right now is the state and local governments put their money in Wall Street banks and earn whatever, 0.2% or something on their deposits. And then Wall Street leverages all that money into loans, which some of which it uses for its own speculation because it's allowed to now that Glass-Steagall has been lifted. But the state and local governments could do that themselves if they brought the deposits back, put them in their own bank, is a money generator for the state, a way they can get money besides having to squeeze their taxpayers. So what do you think of that? Would that work?
I think this is one of what is in fact a broad, big menu of ways to express the popular view, which I think is overwhelmingly the majority perspective, that we have a private enterprise economy that has performed in such a way that the majority of Americans want alternatives. They don't want, poll after poll shows it unambiguously, they don't want a society that distributes its wealth and income as unequally as this one does. And they don't want, therefore, the institutions that contribute to that kind of concentrated wealth. And private banks are, if not the number one, then they're right up there and running for the number one position as institutions that, whatever else they do, are highly committed to and effective concentrators of wealth at the top. So a public bank is one of countless examples that one could come up with of ways to begin to meet what the majority of Americans want. Here is a practical, concrete way that the Institute for Public Banking, you yourself in your work, and whole folks, all kinds of other people, and I might mention Republicans as well as Democrats, led, of course, by the Bank of North Dakota, which is such an example of it. This, of course, is something that could and should be pursued precisely because it is willing to say openly and honestly that it is a public servant. Its job is to help everybody across the public, not to concentrate wealth, to make use of the public's money, all the money we pay in taxes to our state and for that matter also local government, since I think public banks can just as well be local in a city like Santa Fe as well as state level as in North Dakota. This is a way of using the public's money in the leveraging system as you've described it, to earn money for the public by lending. By the way, I'm very impressed by the willingness to lend around the notion that the immediate profit of the loan is not the only determinant of what we do as a public bank, but that issues like long-term community development, social welfare, building up the educational and other infrastructures, these are also criteria for who gets a loan and at what terms. I think this is an exciting initiative. I don't think it's the only one, and I don't think we have to suggest to folks that this is the way, the only way. There's no need for that. This is an interesting process. It can be done. Both in Santa Fe and in lectures that I give, I go to some lengths to point out that in other capitalist countries, we're not even talking socialism yet, in other capitalist countries, publicly owned and operated banks play enormous roles. Germany, but in many countries, they've been doing it for decades. It is so popular, they are so secure, most of these public banks, that like in North Dakota, whether you're a conservative or a liberal, a Democrat or a Republican, these institutions have proven so successful and so popular that nobody in the political spectrum really works against them, because it would be a way to make yourself unpopular awfully quickly, which is rarely a politician's objective. So I think it's a great idea. I think it's just a way for people to break out of the notion that a private enterprise capitalist economy is somehow sacrosanct, can't be improved upon, doesn't have features that we would like to offset. That was a make-believe ideological extreme that captured the minds of people caught up in the Cold War, still befuddles the minds of people who haven't realized that the Cold War and many of the issues it raised are long over. And I think that all of that is beginning to dissolve now, and that the movement for public banking is part of that.
China, for example, is totally practical. I mean, they'll absorb ideas from everywhere, whereas, like, we're very proud and we insist on our capitalist model, but they're running circles around us. I mean, at some point, we have to just recognize that they're doing something that is working for them that we're not doing. I mean, that what they're doing is the government owns the banks, or 80% of the banks, and right. They use that banking power to support their industries, whereas our banks are sucking profits out of our industries. I mean, they're charging as much interest as they can get away with, and then they stick that in offshore tax havens, or, you know, they're not plowing it back into the economy. So the Chinese model is just working better. At some point, we have to say, what are they doing that maybe we might consider doing as well? We're all in this together, really.
Right, I think that the old taboo, which is ideological, that somehow if you find an interesting institution that seems to work well in a country like Russia or China, to say that we ought to pay attention, we ought to study it, we ought to see what way we could learn from it, is somehow tantamount to endorsing communism, and therefore, you know, you shut the conversation down. That was childish stuff. It shouldn't have happened 20, 30, 40 years ago. But now, when, for example, the way I make your point is I say the United States is the largest debtor country in the world, and the People's Republic of China is the largest creditor of the United States. When you have an imbalance as severe as that, you have to ask questions, because if you don't, you're kind of pretending that realities like that, that scream for attention, somehow don't exist. And that's verging on a kind of self-imposed blindness that suggests a society that's spinning out of control. Of course, banks are a social institution. When we teach it, and I've done that in my life, when we teach banking in an economics curriculum at a college or university, undergraduate or graduate level, we explain the very enormous power that banks wield. They are the place into which all of the savings, whether you're planning to save for a week or for 10 years, all the savings of society, or at least a great deal of them, are funneled into banks. So that this is a social function. Businesses and people put their money in the bank because they're not going to use it right away. The banks then move that money into the hands of other people who want to spend it right now but don't have the money to spend. This is a totally social function. It means that all the people who aren't going to spend are giving the banks the money, who can then decide to whom to lend it and who will spend it. How that is worked out, this process, will affect the economic growth and literally everything else about a society. What could be more social than that? And so it becomes a very serious question whether it is wise to put such a social function into the hands of people, private banks, whose first obligation, as they say to us themselves, is to make money for their company. In order for that to be at all rational, you would have to believe that what a bank does in its own interest to make money is exactly identical to what would be best for society to be done with the savings we all have. And to believe that the private profit motive of a bank and the social desirability of how to use savings is always identical is not rational, is not economic. That's a kind of mysticism that really we ought to have outgrown about the time we discovered that Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer was a nice idea, but wasn't really how Christmas worked.
Speaking of economic theory, you were also a keynote speaker at the Rethinking Economics Forum in New York City in mid-September, where I was also on a panel on public banking. The forum was organized by students who questioned the direction that the study of economics has taken, and they wanted to rethink it. My son actually was a six-year graduate student in economics, and he dropped out because he just felt he had gotten into such a narrow specialty, it was econometrics, that it would take him at least another year to finish his dissertation, and he'd just be talking to other econometricists. So he was totally dissatisfied with the program. I just wonder what you think generally about the direction that economic education is going, and whether it's a real science even, or whether it's being manipulated for political purposes to make political policies look good that may not be so good at all.
Yeah, well, I'm in a peculiar position. It's a wonderful question that you ask. And let me tell you why I'm in a peculiar position. I've been a professor of economics all my adult life. Indeed, I still do that. And I went through a graduate program in economics, got my PhD at Yale University, which is generally considered one of the better places to do this sort of thing. So I'm really in and of the profession. But I must say, I have felt, since I was a graduate student, pretty much the way your son felt. That is, I was extraordinarily frustrated, and boy, was I not alone, in thinking that these courses that we were required to take were not practically useful, did not, in fact, teach us how an economy works, which is what we wanted to understand. how the economy in a society shapes the politics and the culture on the one hand, and how the economics are shaped by politics and culture on the other, the exciting questions of why depressions happen and why, all of those really exciting issues that drove many of us to take economics courses, we found to be mostly ignored or treated as side issues. For many of us, like for your son, that was enough. We took a course or two, and then we went on to find something else more exciting, more interesting, more satisfying to study. What was left behind, the people who stayed in economics, did so for one of basically two reasons. Economics was priding itself in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, and it stayed that way pretty much, on being mathematical and rigorous and technical. So the one kind of person who stayed with it was a kind of person, I call them engineering types, for whom the posing of technical puzzles and the finding solutions is what they enjoy, it's what they like. It's like certain people like to put together a chemistry set and make experiments, and other people don't. They prefer to read poetry or whatever it is. And the other kind of person, and here's me, stayed there because we thought that we could get through this boring, technical, narrowly focused material, and then eventually be able to branch out and do what we had always wanted to do, which was to ask and answer the big questions about economics. Anyway, I've thought about this all my life, and here's what I think basically is going on and why economics education is so poor. But before I tell you what it was, I want to tell you what one of the terrible, I mean, I really mean it, terrible social consequences of the poor quality and narrow technical emphasis of economics. One of the consequences of that is that the United States as a society, the mass of Americans, whether they've gone to college or not, are, economically speaking, virtually illiterate. The level of understanding of basic economic institutions and processes that shape all of our lives are simply not understood, misunderstood, or dealt with as mysteries by average people. So that when an economy begins to have trouble, as ours has had in this crisis since 2007, what I encounter as I travel around the country is an immense popular hunger to understand what's going on. Why am I unemployed? Why am I, even though I have a job, finding my employer taking away benefits, harassing me about when I show up exactly? All kinds of things have happened that I don't understand and that are hurting me. Why is it necessary for my child to rack up $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 or more in debt simply to get a bachelor's degree, only then to discover that the kinds of jobs and incomes available to college graduates these days mean that they'll be paying off those student debts for the next 30 years of their lives, et cetera, et cetera. They're hungry to know, and that is a reflection of the fact that the economics taught to them, whether at the high school level or the college level, has been virtually useless in answering all the most important, urgent, and basic questions that are now in their minds. So let me explain why I think that's the case. In the economics profession, particularly up until World War II, even in the United States, there were always many professors, many teachers, who respected students' desire to know basic things about the economy. And not only did they feel that way, but they also felt that having a different point of view, having people who thought about the economy in different ways, people who thought it was a great economy that worked effectively, but also people who were critical and thought that the economy didn't work very well and that there were alternative economic institutions and situations and structures that might work better, these people were thought to be important components of an education. you weren't supposed to learn only the point of view of critics, and you weren't supposed to learn only the point of view of celebrants. You were supposed to engage both perspectives and learn by listening to both sides and forming your own opinion, how to evaluate arguments, how to learn, and how to appreciate both sides of a question, even if you decided yourself you were more on one side than another. But in the Second World War and in the Great Depression, something changed in American education. If I had time, I would think about it and maybe talk with you about what that was. But I know what the result was. Starting in the late 1940s and 50s, two things came together that radically altered economics education. The first one was the recognition by economists in the university, professors of economics, that all the government money flowing into universities, and even much of the corporate money that was flowing into universities to help them build up their faculties, to support university research and all the rest, most of that money was going into what was then called the hard sciences, physics, chemistry, biology, and mathematics. Economists tended then to be looked upon as people who study society, a little bit like, sociologists, historians, things like that, the so-called, quote, soft sciences. And the economists made the decision, wow, it's clear that the harder we can pretend we are, the closer we can make what we do look like what physicists and chemists and astronomers and so forth do, the better off we'll be in the universe of the university, getting the funds from the university, getting funds from Washington to support research, and so forth. And so what economics did was kind of put away the broad, interesting, society-organized and society-focused questions and curriculums, and instead teach their students endless mathematics, how to think of economics always in mathematical terms, focusing on equation systems as if the economy, where all of us have our complicated motives and behaviors, could somehow be reduced to functioning like a machine or something like that. So that changed everything, and that meant that the field became something more interesting to an engineering type student than to someone who had ideas of making society a better place to live. And the second thing that happened, and I think just as important, really was the Cold War. The notion that the United States and the Soviet Union were locked in some horrible battle, and that everybody had to be working to make the United States strong, to make the Soviet Union bad. And if you didn't, if you were somebody who had a criticism of capitalism, instead of that being understood as a reasonable point of view, was understood instead as maybe a sign that you were disloyal, that you didn't care, that you were on the other side. And of course, professors of economics were very frightened about all of this. They were worried about their careers. So they made a quick and easy exit from anything and everything having to do with a critical perspective. And economics became a kind of cheerleading section for capitalism. You could not get a job if you were a critic of capitalism. You couldn't get promoted in a job if you were a critic of capitalism. You could say a variety of things about details, but you had to profess your loyalty, because otherwise you wouldn't be professing anything in an American institution of higher learning, or at least in the vast majority, you would not be welcome. Well, between these two imperatives, economics became A, highly technical, mathematically technical, and number two, became really about justifying and rationalizing and supporting capitalism overwhelmingly, which meant that the training gave you very little insights into the flaws of capitalism, because people who talked about the flaws, the limits, the dysfunctionality of capitalism were considered to be verging on disloyalty, so those who thought that kept their mouth shut, and younger students didn't encounter that kind of a curriculum. I'll give you one concrete example. When I was going to graduate school, which was still in the late 1960s, there were a few universities that still had courses called the business cycle, where the teacher would explain to students that one of the qualities of capitalism since its beginning is this odd and socially destructive situation in which every 3 to 7 years there's an economic downturn. Suddenly, millions of people in the United States lose their job, even though they're doing very effective work. Many, many tens of thousands of businesses go belly up and bankrupt. People lose years of income. It leaves scars on people that really last the rest of their lives. I'm talking economic scars here. And so we had a course that would teach us this is true about capitalism, and at least we would have some examination of why does this terrible thing happen? What have governments tried to do to cope with it? How effective were the government interventions, et cetera, et cetera? By the time I finished my graduate education, there was practically no college or university, and I remember looking into this, that offered such courses. They were considered unnecessary, don't need it. We've learned the great lessons we were told as students. We've learned the great lessons of the Great Depression. We now know how to manage our economies. We'll never have a big crash again. We don't have to worry about that. Of course, as we're talking right now, we're going through the second worst crash in the history of capitalism. All of that, what we were told, is revealed to be what it always was, which is ideological rationalization of capitalism, nothing remotely like scientific examination. Here's the irony that I find so funny about all of this. It wasn't just people who were critical of capitalism who found that they had to study critical perspectives outside of the university, outside of the formal curriculum. That's how I learned it. But we weren't the only ones who were dissatisfied. Here's another group that may surprise you. The business community in America was terribly upset with this arrangement. And I can't tell you the number of meetings I have held, been part of, in various universities across the United States. Meetings between members of the economics department on the one hand and members of another department in the university called the business school on the other. And the representatives of the business school always have the same complaint. They say, look, we rely on the economics department to teach the basics of economics that will help our students learn how a business works, how a business functions in relationship to banks, to the government, to trade unions, all the concrete, real dimensions of economic understanding. But the students you send us, dear colleagues in the economics department, they don't have a clue about any of this. You've been filling their heads with endless courses whose point and purpose is to show that capitalism is efficient, that markets work brilliantly, that what a worker gets is what he ought to get. What you're doing is celebrating and defending capitalism. And while we have no objection to that, we are all capitalists too, and we appreciate that you teach people how wonderful it is. When it comes to preparing students to understand and succeed in the actual economy they live in, you guys are virtually useless. So my answer is, that's what we have in America. We have basically this bizarre situation. We have in almost every university an economics department, but 90% of what it does, and I'm being conservative in my estimate, is celebrate and justify the capitalist system. It does not teach how the economy actually works. To learn that, you have to go, again, in most colleges and universities, to an entirely different department, usually called business school. And in the business school, you learn the nuts and bolts of business, but it's abstracted from all of the interesting political and cultural questions of how business interacts with the larger society. And so in the end, those who want to understand the economy in terms of how it interacts with the rest of society discover they're not going to learn what they want in an economics department, and they're not going to learn what they want in a business school either. And I think that situation has meant that the vast majority of people really know so little about the economy that they depend on so much.
My son, actually, he was dissatisfied with his dissertation, and I said, oh, I know some great subjects, that all these banking subjects, which I think are terribly interesting. And he said, Mom, I didn't take banking. I couldn't believe that you could make it all the way through 6 years of graduate school in economics and not take banking. And I know that when I wrote Web of Debt, I had a friend who was editing it. You know, she would read the chapters, and we'd get all excited about how to rearrange the prose and stuff. And then, like, halfway through, she'd go, now, are you sure that's the way it really works? I mean, we had never been taught that banks create our money. I mean, these very big, it seems to me that they're actually concealing what's going on, and that's why they've made it so complicated so that it looks heavy and boring to most people. They don't really want to get into it. They think, well, I'll leave that to the economists, because, in fact, banks do create the vast majority of our circulating money supply,
right,
and they are reaping the profits from it, and that's something that should be a public function. It should be a public utility, and we, the people, should get the profits. It should be recycled back into the economy.
Right. Well, I'll give you, I mean, just to show you how right you are, we live in a society in which virtually every business that serves the mass of people has gone through countless examples of misbehavior, of producing shoddy products. I mean, to use an example, General Motors recently recalled more cars for defective production of them than the entire number of cars they sold in the last 3 years, all right? There has to then be, if you're an economics profession, you have to have a part of a curriculum, or maybe even a whole course, devoted to asking and answering the following logical questions. One, what is there about the capitalist system that would explain the number, the frequency, in which it turns out that products produced by capitalists are defective? To what extent is the profit motive a cause of this? What can be done about it? How have other societies with different economic systems dealt with these problems? Would it be possible to do better if we don't do any of that? I mean, it never happens. Mm-hmm. For example, in every state in the union, there's a utility commission. What does the utility commission do? It governs the electric utilities and telephone and so on. Why? Because in the history of capitalism, every utility that got to be a monopoly in an area, the only electric company or the only gas company, gouged the prices, made everybody else pay wildly more than they ought to have, so that eventually the citizens and other businesses got together and said, we're going to have a government commission that controls what you charge so you don't be... Okay, that suggests that there's something in this system that produces this kind of behavior. This needs to be studied. We have to understand whether these commissions work. We have to look at other societies in terms of how they solve this problem. And we have to ask the honest, basic questions of whether this is maybe a system problem and whether we ought to have a different system. You're pointing it out these days around banking. And I think one of the reasons you're effective, as you are, is that Americans have figured out, whether they've had a lot of education or not, that the banks, and particularly the big ones, are ripping everybody off. I mean, let's remember, big banks have been paying billions, with a B, in fines for having manipulated interest rates, for having laundered criminal money, for having levied excessive fees, and for having really taken the whole economy down with the way they managed the mortgage situation. I mean, with that record of misbehavior, Americans are saying, my God, there has to be something. We don't have to live in a society where we are subject to this, and it goes on for years, then there's a scandal, they pay a small fine, bearing little relationship to all they made by doing this, which is pretty well an invitation to do more of it, which they continue to be caught doing, et cetera, et cetera. I think you're beginning to get this sense that people, even if they don't have a good economics education, are smart enough to understand when an economic system simply isn't working for the vast majority of people.
Well, that's about all the time we have. It's been really great talking to you, and I love the fact that you support public banking, and you say it all so well and so cleverly.
Well, I'd love to talk with you again in the future, Ellen.
Okay, that sounds great.
All right.
Thanks very much.
Take care.
Our guest has been Dr. Richard Wolff, noted economist, commentator, and theorist. You can also hear him on Economic Update on PRN.FM.
As Eldon mentioned earlier, there was a highly successful symposium in Santa Fe a couple of weeks ago, and there's another one scheduled for Philadelphia, PA, coming up on October 18th, entitled Public Banks for Public Works, which will address some of the key economic challenges that face cities of all sizes. How and from where do you get the money to invest in your local economies so you can address the chronic issues like infrastructure improvement, educational needs, student debt, joblessness, home foreclosures, and so on. Not to mention the exciting prospects of supporting new approaches to energy and community development. Public Banks for Public Works, which you can learn about at publicbankingpa.org, will feature several important voices, including the Washington Post's Harold Meyerson, who will report on how new progressive city administrations aren't waiting for help from Washington to figure out solutions, and Lenore Palladino, the Vice President of Policy at the think tank Demos, who will be discussing the burgeoning crisis of student debt, which is now over $1.3 trillion and growing higher at the expense of future generations. Dr. Robert Hockett, a former guest on this program, will discuss how cities can use eminent domain to get people back into their homes. And there will be a discussion among city officials and activists who are blazing trails into the new economy. Again, that's Saturday, October 18th at the Friends Center in downtown Philadelphia. Information is available at publicbankingpa.org. We'd love to see you there. And if you'd like to hear the presentations made by the speakers at the Santa Fe Conference, including the one delivered by today's guest, Dr. Richard Wolff, visit bankingonnewmexico.org to view the videos. That's it for this edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, brought to you with support from Payment Management Merchant Credit Card Services, dedicated to the cause of economic justice and fairness and to the creation of new American public banks. Visit them at paymentmgmt.com to request a complimentary analysis of your current card processing expenses. For more information about public banking, visit publicbankinginstitute.org. Our thanks to Payment Management, our guests, PRN.FM, and to you for listening. For Ellen Brown, I'm Walt McCree. See you next time on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown.